second reading is taken from Genesis chapter 22, verses 1 to 2 and 6 to 12. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and the wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place that God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. May your word live in us."
At the beginning of the service, Malcolm mentioned that if Alex were not available for the children's spot, that he was going to call on me on the spur of the moment. But I don't think I could ever do the children's spot as well as Alex. Not because I don't have anything to say. It's because my legs aren't as good looking as Alex. No, all kidding aside, if you're like most people, you're not crazy about tests. As a seminary lecturer, I didn't mind giving tests, but as a student for many years, I never really enjoyed taking them, and most of us don't. But tests can be important. Tests are actually quite important because they measure growth, they measure achievement and performance. Matter of fact, cooks and chefs routinely test their own cooking before they serve it to see if the food has turned out all right. And tests are for more than just people. Toyota, for example, if they're launching a new car line, they'll test it rigorously to see if it works right before they sell it. So tests can be good. For people, tests measure all sorts of things. We can be tested physically. For example, if you take a blood test or a heart rate test, or we can be tested to see our cognitive, our learning. And that's what we're most familiar with in school, math tests and other sorts of things. But Christians also face spiritual tests to measure our growth and the strength of our faith. The premier biblical example of a spiritual test, the test of faith, is our dear friend Abraham. And Abraham faces this supreme test in Genesis chapter 22. And in fact, this test is so challenging, it is difficult to imagine what it must have been like for Abraham. So we're going to take a look at this test of faith which Abraham endured and what he underwent to see what we can learn from it, to see what it means, and to see how we can apply it in our own lives. So in turning to Genesis chapter 22, the passage that Chloe has just read for us, we see in the very beginning in verses 1 and 2, it says, "Sometime later, God tested Abraham." And right there we have a foundational statement. It's because God is the one who is testing Abraham. God calls out to Abraham and says, he said to Abraham, "Abraham." "And here I am," he replied. God calls to Abraham. God initiates this test. Now, is this voice of God to Abraham? Was it in Abraham's head? Was it audible? Honestly, the text doesn't tell us. But all we can know for certain is that after many conversations with God, Abraham recognizes God's voice so clearly when he knew it was God. There was no question in his mind this was God because he'd heard God speak before. He'd had conversations with God before. This is not his own idea. It's not an idea from himself. It's not from Satan. This conversation is from God. And the narrator, interestingly, gives us some information that Abraham does not have. We know that it is a test from the beginning because the narrator said, sometime later, God tested Abraham. But Abraham does not know this information at the beginning. It's only after the conclusion of the test, when Abraham is made aware that, in fact, it was a test. And honestly, that's the way it is for us. It's just the same. We only realize later, after the hard time, that this challenge was, in fact, a test from God. And we need to make an important distinction here. A test is not the same as a temptation or a trial. It's an important distinction. A temptation is never from God. It comes from our own desires in a fallen world and from Satan. And it's for the purpose of weakening our faith, of ruining and destroying our faith. So when we fail, when we give in to temptation, it's because of our faltering faith or our weak will. And that differs from a trial. A trial is allowed by God, and it comes from life circumstances, even our own choices at times. And trials are difficult circumstances for the purpose of developing, of growing our faith, strengthening our faith. James chapter 1, verse 2 says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing." However, a test is something altogether different because a test is brought by God. It's not like a trial which is allowed by God. A test is brought by God to determine the strength of our faith, to measure it, to see how far we have developed, to measure us. Now, and so generally speaking, trials develop us, but tests measure us. And typically, we face more trials in our lives than we do tests. And that's not surprising. That's to be expected. We don't need a lot of tests to measure us. Just like in school, you didn't need a test all the time, but we needed lots of trials to develop us, which is why you had homework on a regular basis in school to develop you and your learning. The last thing we need to look at in these first two verses is when God says, "Then God said, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering." This idea of human sacrificing, matter of fact, it for many people, it makes this passage, or for some people at least, it makes this passage abhorrent, or they can't understand what it means. Because human sacrifice was common, actually, in the ancient world, and it would have been very familiar to Abraham. Many societies at the time practiced human sacrifice, and it was primarily to appease the gods. So in their understanding, if you wanted the gods to act on your behalf, to get you to do something for you, particularly in the areas of fertility, whether it was within your family or especially within your flocks and your herds, you could get the gods to work on your behalf by offering that which is most precious to you, a human life. Matter of fact, in the Old Testament, the Canaanite god Molech required child sacrifice, and God routinely and soundly condemns this practice, particularly in the book of Leviticus. And God said he called human sacrifice and child sacrifice abhorrent and repugnant to God. So this passage does not condone or even tolerate human sacrifice. So what then is it about? What is this passage all about? We need to continue on and see, in fact. And when we go ahead to verse 6, we see where it says, "Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife." So Isaac goes on this journey with his father Abraham. So Isaac's role is that Abraham sets out with Isaac and with his servants, and they travel for 3 days. Now, we don't exactly know where Moriah was. It was a region that was 3 days' journey from where Abraham was camped at the time. Some scholars actually believe that it was near where present-day Jerusalem is. The city was not there at the time in Abraham's day, but there's no way to know for sure. Some scholars actually think that the mountain where Abraham was called to sacrifice Isaac was actually Golgotha, where Jesus was crucified. And that while that is a possibility, we just don't know. But the test is off to a very good start because God commands Abraham to go sacrifice. So Abraham gets up early and he goes. This is actually quite similar to Genesis 12, verses 1 through 4, where God initially called Abraham out of his home. God calls Abraham to go, and the text tells us that Abraham gets up and he goes. So we have the same thing repeated here. And Abraham reaches the region of Moriah and he stops. And Abraham and Isaac then go on alone, And Isaac himself carries the wood for the sacrifice. Now, we don't know actually how old Isaac was at this time. The word in Hebrew used to describe Isaac could indicate anyone from the age of an infant up to adolescence. So Isaac, we tend to think of Isaac as a small boy, but it's very possible he was even in fact a teenager. We just simply don't know how old he was, but he may have been even that old. And I tend to think he was a little bit older because, as we'll see in just a moment, he asked a very thoughtful and reflective question of his father. But importantly, Abraham has not yet told Isaac what God had told him. But can you blame him? Can you imagine what that conversation would look like? Son, I meant to tell you, when we get to where we're going, I'm going to bind you, I'm going to slay you, and then I'm going to burn you as an offering, as a human sacrifice to God. I can't imagine it. I just can't even fathom that. So Abraham does not tell Isaac what is ahead, what he believes God has called him to do. But can you imagine what must have been going through Abraham's mind during that three-day journey? The text does not tell us. It doesn't give us a window into Abraham's thinking on this. But all the why questions, the rationalizing, the bargaining with God that we so often do. God, why are you asking me to do this? What is this all about, God? What is this? Can I do something else instead? Maybe take me, not my son Isaac. All these things, whatever his thoughts, whatever's going on in Abraham's head, he keeps them to himself. He doesn't talk about them with Isaac. And he doesn't allow those thoughts to overpower his will to follow through and obey God's command. And then this is where Isaac asked the question, because he's a smart boy. Because Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Isaac is a smart boy. He sees the wood, he sees the fire, he sees the knife, but there's no animal. He knows there has to be an animal for a sacrifice because something living has to die in order for there to be a sacrifice. And Abraham's response is so typical of Abraham as a man of faith, because Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering." This phrase, "God will provide," it's the classic Jehovah Jireh. There's a chorus, a song about that, Jehovah Jireh, my provider. And Abraham is not lying here. He's not making this up. He does, because there are several possibilities. Abraham literally may have meant that Isaac was the lamb, or it could have meant that Abraham believed that at the last minute God was going to give him a reprieve. He was going to change his mind and provide an animal, which is in fact what happens. We don't know what's going on in Abraham's mind about this, but he firmly believed that God somehow would provide the answer to this dilemma. And he didn't have the heart to tell his son Isaac that you, in fact, at this moment are the sacrifice. Abraham didn't know how this was going to work out, but he had every confidence in God who did. And so the message that he gives to Isaac in this is, I trust God, so you can trust me. It's an indication of an incredibly powerful, strong relationship between father and son, between Abraham and Isaac. Because as we look forward ahead of this in chapters 23 through 25 of Genesis, we see no indication of any animosity, no indication of a breakdown in relationship between Isaac toward Abraham. The father-son relationship seems to come out from this, emerge strong enough to survive from this episode. So Abraham and Isaac does not seem to bear any anger or resentment towards his father over this, which is quite remarkable, actually. So Isaac did, in fact, trust his father, Abraham, in the midst of this incredible situation. So then, beginning in verse 9, we see it says, when they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Can you imagine this binding process of Abraham when he binds his son Isaac? And all the questions which would have arisen in the midst of this. Did Isaac struggle when Abraham bound him? At what point did Isaac figure out that the sacrifice is me? And did Isaac accept Abraham's decision, or did he fight against it? We have no way of knowing. The text, incredible as it is, just simply doesn't tell us about this interaction. But I can imagine that there must have been a struggle to some point before Isaac finally submitted. And verse 10 is so fascinating because it says, then he reached, meaning Abraham, reached out his hand and he took the knife to slay his son. You see, Abraham is in the actual act of slaying his son. He's not just walking over to the sacrifice to Isaac. He's not just raising his hand with the knife in it above his head so he could bring it down. The verb here implies that Abraham is in the act of slaying. His arm with the knife is on its way down as God interrupts. It's only then, after Abraham has made his commitment, he's all in, that's when when God intervenes. After Abraham is in, literally in the act of fulfilling it. So God intervenes and he calls out through an angel. He says, stop, Abraham, don't go through with it. There's this emphatic intervention at the last possible moment after Abraham is fully committed. Only after Abraham is literally all in does God intervene and stop him. And then this, Abraham passes the test. And in verse 12, God declares that now I know you fear me and love me more than you love your son. And as Abraham had declared in faith, God in fact did provide a ram for the sacrifice. In verse 13, it says, Abraham looked up. There in a thicket, he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. This is kind of a secondary notion or idea in this passage, but it's a fascinating idea because it's the first foreshadowing of Christ's atoning sacrifice on the cross. Because a sacrificial lamb here dies so that a person, meaning Isaac, can live. Which is exactly what Christ has done for us. So when we take a step back from this passage, now that we've looked at it, why did God command Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac? It's the big question. It's the one everybody wants an answer to. What is this passage really all about? Well, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, thinks he knows. In his book, The God Delusion, he writes about this passage and he says, Abraham's murdering knife was already in his hand when an angel dramatically intervened with the news of a last-minute change of plans. God was only joking, tempting Abraham and testing his faith. A modern moralist cannot help but wonder how a child could ever recover from such a psychological trauma. By the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example of child abuse, bullying, and the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense, I was only following orders. And Dawkins concludes, therefore, that this is child abuse of the first order from a wicked, horrible God. And he has no desire to believe in such a God or to serve such a God. Now, Richard Dawkins may be a good biologist, but he's actually a very bad theologian. Because he misunderstands this passage. He misses the point completely. This passage is not about child sacrifice. God is not playing a joke on Abraham. God never intended for Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. He never would have allowed Abraham to go through with it. Because either Abraham fails the test, at which point Isaac is surely safe and nothing happens to him, or God will stop it before Abraham goes through with it. So either way, Isaac is never in danger of dying. This is not about child sacrifice. The passage is about one thing and only one thing. Idolatry. This passage is about idolatry. God is testing Abraham to see if he has made an idol out of Isaac. He's testing Abraham to see if he loves his son more than he loves God. He's trying to determine who has first place in Abraham's heart. God or Isaac. By Abraham's willingness to sacrifice, to literally get rid of his son, he demonstrates that God is the most important thing. God is the most important person, the most important commitment in his life. So what is this thing called idolatry? Well, 500 years after Abraham, Moses comes along, and in Exodus chapter 20, he writes, under the inspiration of God, the Ten Commandments. He writes what God has given him. And the first of those Ten Commandments says, you shall have no other gods before me. It's a prohibition against idolatry. And it's the first commandment of the Ten because it's the single most important commandment of the Ten. It's the one most often broken. Now, we don't normally think about that, but it is the one most often broken. Matter of fact, I would argue every time we sin, we break the first commandment. Because this is not just about deities. It's not just about other transcendent beings. It's not just about bowing down to little statues or statuettes. It's about allowing or placing anything else in our life higher than God. And every time we sin, we do that. It's about allowing in our heart, in our devotion, in our priorities, in our practices or our commitments, something else to be higher than God. John Calvin, the reformer, once said, every one of us is, even from his mother's womb, a master craftsman of idols. Because we can literally make an idol out of anything, and we do. David Gill, a contemporary ethicist, has written that he's reinterpreted the Ten Commandments, or not reinterpreted so much as explained them in a contemporary language and in a wider context. He says this prohibition against idolatry is literally giving love that should be reserved for God to anyone or anything else. Giving love that should be reserved for God to anyone or anything else. And that is exactly what God is testing Abraham for. Had Abraham elevated Isaac to a place of love which should belong only to God? That's what God wanted to find out. Matter of fact, in Matthew chapter 22, Jesus was challenged, what is the greatest commandment? And in verse 27 of that chapter, Jesus responds, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And that's come to be called the great commandment. But it implies something on the opposite, which is the greatest sin then, which is the opposite of that, is loving something else with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, more than God. And in fact, that is, again, idolatry. That's why in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 14, Paul just puts it straight out there. He says, therefore, my friends, flee from idolatry. So if idolatry is a concern for Abraham, so much so that God tests him about it, if it was a concern for Moses that he wrote about it in the first of the Ten Commandments as he received that from God, if it was a concern in Jesus' day and for Paul, do you think it might be a concern for us today as well? Well, I think we can answer that question by looking at our own hearts and what are our own priorities. Now, it's obvious to me that every one of you this morning, God is somewhere in your priorities or you wouldn't be here. I didn't see anybody being dragged in against their will this morning, so I think we can set that aside. But the question still remains, is anything else challenging God for top priority in your life? Martin Luther once said, that to which your heart clings is your God. I think he's correct about that. And we can make an idol out of anything. Idols can be very good things in our lives. It could be a talent. It could be an ability we have, a skill. An idol could be an achievement or a position. Maybe your position at work or your employer, or if you own a business, maybe what you've achieved in that regard. An idol could be a person or a relationship like it was for Abraham or potentially was with Abraham. It could be some work that you do. It could be material possessions. It could be your house or your car or your boat. It could be your finances or your superannuation fund. It could be vacations or trips that you take. It could be your dreams or your goals, anything that is higher than God. It could be leisure activities. It could be sports. I'm beginning to understand here that in Australia, it could even be, dare I say, footy. I know I tread on dangerous ground in saying that, though. Idols can also be things that are misused, things that we don't want to surrender to God but aren't very healthy for us. Maybe our thought life or our language or friends that are not beneficial for us. It can be things that we become obsessed with, such as computer usage or technology. And if there's any one piece of technology that may qualify as being an idol for some people, it's their hand phone, to be honest. Because our dependence upon it, our incessant use of it. Not that it's not a good thing, but it's our overuse and dependence upon it. It can be literally anything which we value more or place higher than God. And honestly, like Abraham, we usually don't realize it. Abraham, when we look at him, Abraham was not aware of what was going on. He was not aware of the danger that Isaac had become that he could have become an idol. So I think if you're undergoing what you would consider to be a test today, maybe we need to take a step back and look. Maybe God is trying to warn you, to raise the awareness and expose something that's an idol in your life. We need to look at tests in that fashion to see what God might be trying to teach us. When we look at Matthew chapter 19, Jesus challenges the rich young ruler who comes up to him to let go of his wealth, to give it up, to leave it behind, and then follow Jesus. But as we all know, the young man wouldn't do it. His money and his wealth had become an idol to him, and he couldn't part with it. He could not let it go. But in contrast to that, in Luke chapter 19, from the gospel reading this morning, we have Zacchaeus, who Jesus comes to his house, and Zacchaeus also is tested, but he passes the test because he declares to Jesus, today I'm going to give half of my possessions to the poor. Zacchaeus passes this test to show that material, even though he had a lot of material possessions, they didn't own him. They didn't control him. They weren't higher in his life than God. He didn't love them more than he loved God. And what does Jesus call Zacchaeus? He says, salvation has come to this household, for this man too is a son of Abraham. Because Zacchaeus passes the test.
So Abraham and the rich young ruler and Zacchaeus, they all face the idolatry test, which is, can you give it up? Can you lay it down? Can you sacrifice it? Can you do without? Is God more important? Abraham passed the test. Zacchaeus passed the test. But the rich young ruler, he failed the test. And often, like Abraham and the rich young ruler, the idol is that which is closest to us. It is that thing or that person which is most important. So if you're looking for idols in your life, and I encourage you to do that on a regular basis, self-examination, we need to look at what is closest to us. It's difficult to make an idol out of something that's far away. We tend to make idols out of things that are closest to our hearts, what we're really good at, what we value the most. And I know for me, I'd have to say in all honesty that looking back, I had kind of made an idol out of where I used to live in the United States. And so I believe God led me to move away to Singapore as a way of letting go of that idol. I think in retrospect, I had actually made an idol out of my house. It wasn't an overly large house, but it was something that I was really attached to in an unhealthy way. And so I ended up having to sell it. I think I was attached, in all honesty, to my SUV. We had this, Tammy and I bought this black Toyota SUV just before we moved, and I loved that vehicle. And so I had to sell it. And it's even possible, as I've been reflecting on this and even preparing for this message, it's even possible that part of God leading me and Tammy here to Albany was about removing another idol. You see, my teaching gift had become an idol of sorts in Singapore. It may have. And Albany is a part of God's greater plan to remove that idol. Not by eliminating it completely, but by knocking it down a few notches. It's not been easy because I take a lot of identity, I always have, from my teaching. But the difficulty of letting go of that has convinced me that it probably was or has been and had become an idol. So I want to ask you this morning, what is that one thing which may be an idol in your life or could become an idol if it's not already because you love it too much, potentially more than God? What I'd like us to do this morning is for you to bow your heads and your hearts with me. And I want to pray a prayer, but I'd like you to pray it after me. So I'm going to say a phrase or just a brief few words, then I'd like you to repeat that after me. You can say it silently, or if you feel comfortable, you can say it out loud as well. But just a prayer of confession and a prayer of examination, allowing God to take this message and to apply it to our lives. So let's pray. Father God, I confess the tendency to sometimes love other things more than you. I invite your Holy Spirit to shine a light in my heart and expose anything there which might be an idol. Lord Jesus, if there is anything in my life which is tempting me to love it more than you, I lay it down. I surrender it now. I offer it to you as a sacrifice. Give me the courage to, like Abraham, love you above all else and be willing to let go of anything which has become an idol. Amen.